Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, April 20th, 2017. Aid agencies say it is hard to do their work in South Sudan because of many actors.
We had several weeks ago some people that were abducted in Mayandit, right in the middle of the famine area. And the people that took them was an offshoot of one of the armed sides, and they were acting unilaterally of their own volition. So they didn't have orders. They just thought that was a good thing to go do.
And judges in South Sudan threaten to go on strike next week if the government fails to meet their demands.
The Honorable Chief Justice Chan Richmadun must resign so matter from his post. Provision of cars for justices and judges for their transportation, provision of stationaries, and creation of conducive working environment.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Aid agencies in South Sudan are struggling to deliver emergency food aid and other assistance as ever-evolving mushrooming of armed groups makes travel more and more dangerous. VOA's East Africa correspondent Jill Craig explains.
Ending the conflict and preventing more famine in South Sudan are entwined, but the situation on the ground only grows more complex.
We have a much more chaotic situation on the ground than, let's say, 2 years ago when we had one government, one armed opposition.
Casey Copeland, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, says there are now dozens of armed opposition groups.
A handful of them are able to engage the government in pitched battles. Others simply don't have any means to actually fight the government. So the most they can do are things like road ambushes of government convoys and things like that. But at the same time, of course, that means also road ambushes of anyone, and a situation of rebellion can then easily start to look like general banditry and insecurity.
The confusion is not limited to the opposition. Allied militia operate on the government side as well. Witnesses to recent attacks on civilians in Wau and Equatoria have said the attackers were men in uniform. Sometimes it is not clear whether attackers are soldiers, militia, or rebels. Ken Isaacs is vice president of programs and government relations at U.S.-based charity Samaritan's Purse, whose staff members were briefly held captive in Mayandit, one of two counties in Unity State where the U.N. has declared a famine.
We had several weeks ago some people that were abducted in Mayandit, right in the middle of the famine area. And the people that took them was an offshoot of one of the armed sides, and they were acting unilaterally of their own volition. So they didn't have orders. They just thought that was a good thing to go do, is to kidnap those guys, you know, to abduct them.
The violence has a ripple effect. Take Equatoria, for example. Copeland calls it the food belt of South Sudan, a key breadbasket and transit point. She says that fighting there has cut off food supplies to other parts of the country. The chaos has made it even harder for aid agencies to operate. The UN said Wednesday that the conflict has killed 82 aid workers and displaced 3.5 million people since it began in December 2013. The UN has warned repeatedly of a looming genocide in South Sudan, but Copeland cautions against calling this an ethnic conflict, pitting President Salva Kiir's Dinka tribe against that of former vice president and opposition leader Riek Machar's Nuer.
When we look at the transitional government, what we don't see is what a lot of people say, is that it is sort of a Dinka domination. Actually, we find ministers from Equatoria, the national security minister is an Equatorian. We find senior Nuer in several different key ministries. So we do see that calling it an ethnic conflict, or as some would say tribal, it's too simplistic, actually.
John Mukumbaku is an economics professor at Weber State University and works on African governance issues. He says that South Sudan's political leaders on both sides are to blame for the situation.
These are highly educated people. These are people who understand the consequences of violence, and yet they are still not willing to sit down and try to prevent this violence from taking place. And I think that if they don't do something about it, history will remember them not as nationalists who tried to develop a country, but as monsters who were specifically interested only in their own personal interests.
Violence against civilians has escalated since the breakdown of a 2015 peace deal. The UN and the government have projected that by July, roughly half of the country will be severely food insecure. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A South Sudanese woman seeking protection at a refugee collection center at the Ugandan border town of Elegu says she was forced to flee her country after she was sexually abused by men in uniform who threatened to kill her. For privacy concerns, we will not use the real name of the woman. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Elegu in Amaro District, northern Uganda.
A woman whom we shall call Joyce Jones in this story says she was traumatized by what happened to her, so she left South Sudan. She says she was raped while traveling to Juba from her hometown of Mundri in the former Western Equatoria state last month. Gunmen attacked their vehicle and forced the driver to stop. She says all the passengers were ordered to step out of the vehicle. Jones, a mother of six, says her nightmare began as soon as she got out of the vehicle.
I was taken to the bush, and another girl also was taken that side. So they say, remove all your clothes. So for me, I say, why do I remove? They say, if you don't remove, then we are going to kill you. Due to that fear, I say, God, now I don't have anything to say. I remove the clothes.
Jones says she heard many cases of soldiers and armed men raping young girls and elderly women across the country during the 3.5-year conflict, but she never imagined it would happen to her one day. The middle-aged woman says after she removed her clothes as ordered by the armed men, one of the men asked about her health status.
He said, are you sick? I say, which kind of sickness? He said, do you have virus? I say, which type of virus do you want? He said, are you having any kind of disease? I say, no. Which one do you like? Do you like HIV or syphilis or some other diseases?
Jones says the gunman told her to cooperate or she will die.
He said, now, I'm going to use you just now. I say, how are you going to use me? Am I your wife? He said, if you are still continue talking, just now I'm going to kill you. I said, please don't kill me. He said, now, I'm going to make sex just now with you. I kept quiet.
Jones broke down in tears as she continued to describe her ordeal. She says she could not tell if the men were government soldiers or armed criminals as it was dark. She says she was only able to tell they wore different types of military uniforms.
It was tonight. I cannot identify them. But what I saw, they were putting on as if they were mixed in clothes. But I cannot tell. Because for those who are having guns, you cannot even identify them. Whatever they want to do, they do it as they wish.
Jones says the incident has devastated her. She says she arrived in Juba 2 days later and immediately quit her job, packed a few belongings, and left the country she once loved.
Now I don't know. I say, if that is the case, let me go and look for help as others are doing. Maybe my children will be educated for next generation.
Human Rights Watch and other local South Sudanese non-governmental organizations have accused both government soldiers and armed opposition forces of repeatedly raping South Sudanese women. Last July, some elements of the South Sudan Army raped foreign aid workers at a hotel in Juba near the base of the UN mission in South Sudan. The government formed a committee to investigate the allegations, but no tangible actions have been taken against the rapists. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
Judges in South Sudan have threatened to go on strike next week if their demands are not met. The judges want President Salva Kiir to fire the Chief Justice and increase the salaries of all judges across the country. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
At a news conference held this afternoon at the judiciary headquarters in Juba, judges told the reporters that their living conditions have deteriorated due to poor leadership at the institution. The judges blame South Sudan's Chief Justice Chan Rich Madut for not addressing the issues affecting judges across the country. Justice Gary Raimondo with the South Sudan Court of Appeals read a joint statement on behalf of his colleagues at the judiciary today.
The Honorable Chief Justice never conducts any single meeting with the members of the Supreme Court to discuss problems of the judiciary, which resulted into no transparency, no check and balance. There is also mismanagement of judiciary of South Sudan assets and human resources. We have reached to the extent that more than 4 judges sharing one courtroom.
Justice Raimondo says there are only 3 vehicles providing transportation for 62 judges in Juba to arrive at their places of work. He says 5 other vehicles donated by President Salva Kiir have all broken down and are not being serviced. The judges have given the government until next week to address their concerns. Justice Raimondo read from a list of the judges' demands.
The Honorable Chief Justice Chan Rich Modun must resign so matter from his post. Provision of cars for justices and judges for their transportation, provision of stationaries and creation of conducive working environment, creation of court rooms to each and every judge, appointment of judges and adequate of supporting staff, establishment of court police unit and increment of court police in various courts, creation of library in the judiciary and South Sudan law general and report, provision of judges' identity cards, increment of judges' salaries with immediate effect.
Raimondo says a junior judge in the judiciary receives 4,000 South Sudanese pounds, which is equivalent to $22. The judges are also demanding pay rises and additional allowances for uniforms, health insurances, and legislation to enact pensions for 274 judges across South Sudan. Justice Khalid Muhammad Abdallah is the chairperson of the Justices and Judges Committee of the Judiciary of South Sudan. He says the country's economic crisis has affected the image of the judiciary. He says it is unacceptable that judges have no means of transport and are forced to take public transportation.
We generate income as a judiciary, but our main problem is that, you know, the income which we have here in judiciary is enough to cater for our basic needs. To extend that, we don't need any penny from the Ministry of Finance. This situation is created by Chief Justice because we are lacking transparency.
Abdallah says the working environment at the judiciary and the ongoing economic crisis could compromise the independence of the institution.
Because of this situation, the judges will run into corruption. This is our fear. This is our main fear now. And we can notice, you know, the public are starting talking about the judiciary, the behavior of judges. I'm not accusing my colleagues, but I think there is something like this happening, corruption. This is why we are trying, you know, to correct this situation as quick as possible.
South Sudan in Focus called the Chief Justice Chan Rich Madut for a comment. Justice Madut called the press conference illegal and said he could not comment on the issue over the phone. Justice Madut was appointed by President Kiir in 2011 after he served as chairperson of the South Sudan Referendum Commission, a body that steered the referendum of South Sudan, which led to the secession of the country from Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the rate of HIV/AIDS infections is rising in Yei's town. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African country do you admire most?
I admire Nigerians. They are very bold and they are go-getters.
I admire DRC Congo because of their music. They perform the best of music ever in Africa. even though you don't understand what their language, but you admire their music.
I admire Ghana. It's my country, it's my motherland. Moreover, the culture of Ghanaians are unique. We are also very, very hospitable.
I love my country, South Sudan, and I'm so proud of it, despite of the ongoing ups and downs.
I admire Botswana, because Botswana is a good country, it's a cool country. You know, they don't have this other corrupt, other things that are happening in other countries. They're like just like Switzerland in Europe, yeah.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. The rate of new HIV/AIDS infection in Yei River State is worrying health workers. As Daniel Martin Friday reports from Yei, an estimated 4,000 HIV-positive patients in the state have enrolled to receive medication.
Between 2016 and early 2017, health workers say a high rate of HIV/AIDS has been recorded among youth and pregnant women and girls in Yei River. Chaplain Yuga is the focal point person for HIV and AIDS Commission at Yei Civil Hospital. He says the country's economic challenges and poverty have played a major role in the new infections.
HIV is a disease that is of concern in this town, Yei. We had a total of cumulative patients who are enrolled in this center in care, making the total of 4,276. The youth, because they become active for sexual activities, this is how I term it, as social interaction. Others, poverty related, in which even wives of some people do sneak to other men for gaining of money.
An HIV-positive resident of Yei Town who spoke on condition of anonymity says the way South Sudanese perceive the disease is contributing to the spread of HIV/AIDS across South Sudan.
People living with HIV/AIDS are being stigmatized in any aspect, even if it's in the hospital, in the community, in the church. Stigma prevails everywhere. But some 4 months back, our treatment was not complete. We had separate missing in the component, so it is really very difficult. We are begging the government to work on that, because all of us have the rights to life.
James is HIV positive. He says the presence of insecurity has forced many people who are positive to flee to rural areas where there is no access to treatment or health care. James believes that without peace and stability in the area, HIV prevalence will continue to rise.
We have a lot of challenges, especially in getting drugs. Because of access, people are now in bushes. There's no way for them to come and collect their drugs in time. What people wanted is peace. When peace is there, there is a free movement, and by taking drugs in time, the rate of HIV, I think, can be reduced.
The Yei River State Minister of Health, Kogomana, says ongoing insecurity has forced many organizations working with HIV/AIDS patients to leave the state. But Kogo says despite the current challenges, there is need for a combined approach to fight the spread of new HIV infections.
This is a silent killer disease that needs a joint effort. Because at the moment, given the cost of living, particularly in regards to the economic situation, it exposes majority of our clients to difficult hardships, which sometimes exposes them to unnecessary behaviors that may even lead to a spread of HIV into other areas.
The South Sudan HIV/AIDS Commission says there's high HIV prevalence in people with higher risky behaviors. Commercial sex work is common in South Sudan and is practiced in both rural and urban areas throughout the country. It is especially concentrated in border towns in Juba and at truck stops along the Kampala-Juba Road. One study estimates the number of HIV workers in Juba to be between 2,000 and 4,000, and most of them are underage. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
From Yei, we move to Uganda, where the military says it has begun withdrawing from the Central Africa Republic, saying it has defeated the Lord's Resistance Army rebels. The LRA has been fighting the Ugandan government since the late 1980s. But Reuters quotes the Uganda People's Defense Force as saying the LRA has lost its means of waging war and no longer poses a significant threat. Pamela Faber, with the Washington-based CNA Corporation and author of a new report on the LRA, tells VOA's James Batty that while the LRA has been degraded, most of the environmental conditions that it has strived in over years still exist, and the group may reemerge.
I think the research shows that the LRA is, in fact, a deeply degraded group. It is a group that really is a vestige of what it once was when it was able to kill over 100,000 people. That said, the group still exists, Kony is still alive, and they are still abducting. I think most importantly, the environmental conditions that allowed the group to really emerge in the first place, they still exist in many of the places that the LRA currently functions, including Northeast DRC, Central African Republic, etc. And so while the group is deeply degraded, it may have an opportunity for a resurgence based on the environmental conditions.
Many armies have been looking for the LRA, particularly Joseph Kony, including even the U.S. Africa Command. But still, as you mentioned, they have been resilient. So what do you think has contributed to the resiliency of the LRA?
Well, there are two major things that I believe have contributed to the resiliency of the LRA on the tactical level. The first is their defensive maneuvering. They've managed to, since fleeing Uganda, they've traveled thousands of kilometers across several countries. They've broken up into small, mobile bands that hide in very sparsely populated border zones. But they've also decreased their abductions, and they've developed a new relationship with civilians on the ground. For instance, they've become increasingly involved in networks of criminality and smuggling, and so they really have adapted to their new circumstances. I think the LRA finds itself in a position where it is a very destructive but small force at this point within Central Africa amongst a very complicated and chaotic geopolitical arrangement where you have rivalry and often perhaps poor relations between some countries in the region, historically Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda, etc. And you also have ongoing conflicts in the region, civil conflicts in the Central African Republic, in the northeast of the DRC, in South Sudan, of course. And so the LRA is able to maneuver amongst and between these conflicts in a way that a larger group may not really be able to, and also in a way that allows it to find relationships for support and safe haven.
Do you think, Pamela, that anyone can claim victory over the LRA, short of capturing, say, Joseph Kony, because I think he embodies this organization?
I think Joseph Kony certainly embodies the LRA. I also think that Joseph Kony is, in some ways, a deeply disabled individual now. There is evidence that he is not necessarily in communication with various LRA splinter groups that are on the ground, and they may be functioning independently of one another. That said, the fact that Joseph Kony is still alive does serve as a strong symbol for the LRA, and it can continue to be a rallying call for LRA combatants.
That's Pamela Faber with the Washington-based CNA Corporation speaking to VOA's James Batty earlier today. In Zimbabwe, the past 24 hours have seen the opposition form two new alliances to challenge the country's longtime leader, President Robert Mugabe, in 2018 elections. From Harare, Sebastian Mwaufu has more for VOA.
Zimbabwe's top opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai and former Vice President Joyce Mujuru, signed a coalition agreement late Wednesday. Tsvangirai brings with him a large, well-established opposition party, while Mujuru, a former top Mugabe ally, brings with her defectors from the ruling ZANU-PF. Tsvangirai spoke at the signing, but he did not say who will be the coalition flag bearer in the next year's presidential race.
We shall drive a comprehensive democratization and transformation agenda. Similar arrangements will be entered into with other political formations, and they will inform you as it happens.
Indeed, on Thursday, Tsvangirai signed another agreement with a fellow long-time opposition leader, Welshman Ngwe, healing a rift between the two men that began more than 10 years ago. Meanwhile, civil society activist and Christian pastor Ivan Mawarire, the leader of the country's hashtag This Flag movement, has been called to appear in Harare Magistrate Court Friday. Mawari led several anti-government protests in 2016 calling for action on human rights abuses and the worsening economy. Mawari was arrested in January, accused of subversion and insulting the national flag. On Thursday, Depros Muchena, Amnesty International Regional Director for Southern Africa, said the state should drop all charges.
The Zimbabwean authorities want to make an example out of Pastor Ivan Mawarire to send a clear message to anyone who dares dissent.
Muchena said the government is using criminal justice to harass and silence peaceful activists. The acting prosecutor general, Ray Gowa, dismissed allegations of persecution at Mawarire's last court appearance in February. He said the courts would settle the matter. Sebastian Mwofu for VOA News, Harare.
That report by Mwofu from Harare brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Anna Sori by Sultan Clinton.
This is my story, true story. Harare seeking me.
Montala sibuana,
ekaman sibulana waraka.
Fera serire,
garoku roma ke jatani kulukulu.
Umadara ena tayu kulukulu.
Atiti sora na dukuita, sore de kolumerisa. Na umba unisale,
anaro ala jiranta iye. Anaduku babdomo, umone aina na genimula na gali madam taki kutu.
Alferastai, mafu. Ana bika zatu kana bujumu, ana burale mwana.
Dunia bika zatu makwe,
yesia.
Asani tamafi, dunia bika makwe. Iya taimafi, family tayi with you too. Baby rito warna,
ana sore,
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 baby ana sore,
ana sore,
ana sore,
ana sore.
We have been listening to Sultan Clinton with the song Anna Sori. I am John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you shared your evening with us. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
boda boda. Get even in so family die.